Thank you. Please be seated. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in King v. Dallas Fire Insurance Company.
May it please the court, Mr. Ernest Wilson, you present arguments for the petitioners. Mr. Wilson has allotted 5 minutes, and Mr. Mahalan, representing Amicus, and has reserved 3 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, Carlisle King is seeking insurance coverage for claims that he negligently hired, trained, and supervised one of his employees, Carlos Lopez, who was involved in an altercation with another man named Greg Jankowiak. Mr. King is asking this court to reverse the Court of Appeals holding that imputed Mr. Lopez's allegedly wrongful intent to Mr. King to deprive him of his insurance coverage under his commercial general liability policy. The Court of Appeals opinion in this case, the first error that it made was in failing to use the appropriate test for determining whether an event is an accident. This court has looked at the term accident in insurance policy cases over the years in cases involving life insurance. Those cases start out with the Hutchinson case.
Why are those cases applicable to a liability policy?
Because they use the and interpret the term accident. Those are the only cases.
But in a very different context.
It is true that they are in the life insurance context. However, they are looking at what it means to have an event that is an accident or is not an accident.
Well, why aren't we looking instead at the Cowan case, which addresses the question of accident in the context of a liability policy?
And indeed, the Cowan case is in a commercial liability policy, and it looks at the Hayward case and the Hutchinson line of cases for guidance on what it means to be an accident. The Trinity case does not address the exact issues that this case presents, because in the Trinity case, Mr. Gage, who was involved in the dissemination of pictures that got back to the woman in the pictures, was the actual person seeking insurance coverage. In this case, by analogy, it would be as if Mr. Lopez was seeking coverage. In this case, it's not Mr. Lopez seeking coverage. It is Carlisle King seeking coverage for direct negligence claims against him, claims that his own conduct failed in failing to get a background check, in failing to adequately supervise Carlos Lopez, that's what caused the altercation between Mr. Lopez and Mr.
Well, then aren't you really taking the position that in fact is the occurrence for purposes of the policy, as opposed to the actual physical contact that occurred that caused the injury? Isn't that what you have to do?
We are taking the position that the occurrence in this case is the failure to do the background check, the failure to supervise Mr. Lopez adequately or reasonably as alleged, that led to the altercation between Mr. Lopez
so
and Mr. Jankowiak.
So you're taking the position that for purposes of your client's claim for club coverage, the occurrence is not the altercation, but the occurrence was the negligent hiring and at the point in time when that occurred.
That's correct, and that's what's in the pleading that was asserted against Mr. King.
Do you have any authority for the fact that under those circumstances, when you have something like this, where you have direct liability claims being made against two insureds for different activity, that in fact anything but the actual injury event is the occurrence?
Well, this
typically we think of. I'm sorry. Typically we think of the occurrence as being the car wreck, the fight, the whatever, the actual event when the harm occurred.
Well, in any case involving negligent hiring or negligent training or negligent supervision, the occurrence would be broadly defined as those.
Right. And then my question to you is, do you have any authority from Texas or in any other jurisdiction or secondary materials on insurance law in which an occurrence under an insurance policy is ever determined to be anything except the event, meaning the injury itself?
Well, to directly answer the court's question, I believe there is some secondary authority cited in the briefing, the couch on insurance. It may not phrase it exactly that way, and I believe Appleman's also cited in the briefing stands for the proposition that when you have this type of negligent hiring or a claim against an employer for what the employee has done, that you would look at it broadly from the occurrence, including the claims about negligent hiring, negligent supervision, and that you would broadly define the occurrence to meet that.
Are there any courts that have adopted that view as opposed to, in other words, I mean, basically you're saying there are two occurrences here, two separate occurrences.
I love the phrase a little bit differently. I think the occurrence is broadly defined as one big occurrence, which was the hiring, the failing to supervise, that later led to the altercation. As for authority that supports Carlisle King's position, those are also included in the briefing.
Now, in terms of this specific question about occurrence, that's what I'm trying to focus the authority that you've cited. Is there anything that goes to your view of how we would look at occurrence when, in fact, we're looking at two separate courses of conduct that led to the injury?
I'm not aware of any case that would say exactly that. I think you can look at the cases that imply the separation of insurers, and that's in effect what they're doing. Those would be the Silverball Amusement case and some of the other cases talking about the separation of insurers, but particularly that language.
So, I mean, isn't it really the case then, I mean, you've just led to my next question, that in fact for us to adopt your view of occurrence, we really have to look at the separation of insureds provision of the policy in order to go back to occurrence and look at it in the way that you want us to?
I don't believe that's true. I believe that the term accident, as this term has applied it in those life insurance cases, requires the court to look at the events from somebody's viewpoint. And that the viewpoint that the court said you should adopt in determining whether an event or series of events is an accident is the viewpoint of the insurer.
But you talked about some secondary authority. Appleman uses that rationale, that the occurrence is viewed from the insured's point of view as to whether it was an intended event or an accident. But Trinity Universal makes the specific reference to the fact that the policy, like the policy here, has deleted language dealing with the view of the insured and dropped it down to the exclusion for intentional conduct. And so Trinity really is predicated on the notion that you don't look at the accident viewed from the insured. And so doesn't that pose a unique circumstance for your argument?
Certainly that language from Trinity is intention, but I think the language from that paragraph, Trinity's intention with the rest of what this court says of Trinity itself, if I can elaborate on that a little bit further.
Well, it may be, but they were only dealing with one actor. They weren't dealing with the separation of insureds, but it plays a more significant role in the separation of insureds, doesn't it?
That's exactly right, Your Honor. That language comes when this court is responding to the Court of Appeals argument in Trinity and to Gage's argument that I never intended these photographs to get back to the woman who's in them. That wasn't something my subjective intent. The way I read that paragraph, to be consistent with the rest of this court's language in Trinity, is that this court is saying you don't look at it from the subjective standpoint. And we know that because this, when viewed from the standpoint of the insured language, it's outside, it's no longer part of the occurrence definition. That language has been used by Dallas Fire in this case to support a broad proposition that intentional conduct takes an event or series of events outside of an accident. And certainly that's the same argument that this court rejected in Trinity itself. In Trinity, this court said that we're going to reject the argument that if an actor intended to engage in the conduct that gave rise to the injury, there can be no accident. This court said, no, that's not what we think is the appropriate definition of accident. And the reason that we think that's not appropriate is because it makes the intentional exclusion irrelevant, and because it defeats the normal expectation of the insureds. And the court went on in Trinity to provide a couple of examples of intentional conduct that it felt would be covered by an accident policy. It talks in Trinity about the example of the deer hunter. If you intend to shoot at the bushes and you think you're hitting a deer and you actually hit a person, that's still something that the court felt should be covered, and was an example that the court itself provided. And it follows up on an earlier example that this court provided in the Hayward case, having to do if you're walking on the side of the road and you're run down by somebody. That's an event that should be covered regardless of whether the person didn't intend to run you down or whether they did intend to run you down. So certainly the proposition that you can take that isolated paragraph out of Trinity and hold it up and say that means that as the Court of Appeals said, an occurrence that is not the result of an intentional act and which could not reasonably have been anticipated by causing the occurrence is an accident. The Court of Appeals' definition of an accident is simply irreconcilable with what this Court said in
now,
the case.
Going back to your comment about the authorities that are here, as I look at them, it really seems that there's actually a subset within the authorities dealing with a particular allegation of negligent hiring versus some other allegation. I was shooting my rifle. It was target practice, and I killed an individual with me. I intended to shoot the gun, but I didn't intend the death. That's an accident. That's one kind of theory that's out there. But Appelman sort of acknowledges that this separation of insured, this whole notion that's out there, is something the courts really haven't looked at when it's talking about issues other than negligent hiring. The treatise seems to acknowledge that if negligent hiring is the specific allegation, he doesn't have as much complaint about the court's failure to study this coverage viewed from the insurer's point of view, the intention viewed from the insurer. He doesn't seem to say that that exception is a particular problem in negligent hiring. And then if you look at the authorities out there, it seems that most of the authorities that say that the occurrence is the critical question and the occurrence was the result of intentional conduct, therefore there's no claim for negligent hiring, no coverage for negligent hiring, seem to be one set of cases that seem to be fairly uniform. And it's only when you get to a parent responsible for a child's intentional conduct or for some other special relationship that exceeds out there where the courts seem to split as to whether it's coverage or not.
Well, if I can make two comments to that, there does seem to be one central theme in this case. One theme in the case is what is an accident? How do we go about defining what an accident is? The other is what do we do about these cases interpreting Texas law in which the courts have said the employer is imputed with the intent of the employee, and that seems to come up in the separation of insureds and the negligent hiring context. I think the idea that you impute the employee's intent to the employer in these coverage cases is inconsistent with what this court has done, say, when the husband burns down the house, you don't impute the husband's intent to the wife to deprive her of coverage. And likewise, if we were talking about a liability issue, you would not
say... Okay, let me stop right there, not to interrupt your thought, but that was the point I made inarticulately. Our court doesn't impute intent in a husband-wife or a parent-child, but the court does in negligent hiring cases. And it's not really the imputing the intent. It's the occurrence discussion seems to be different if the court's dealing with negligent hiring than any of those other factors, cases you're talking about.
Well, in those cases in which you do, and I'm not aware of this court saying or this particular insurance issue being addressed by this court, the cases that have imputed the intent are done only in the employer-employee context. And I see no reason to do that. I don't think that is consistent, again, with what you do in the matrimonial cases in which you have the husband, largely seems to be the husband, burning down the house and the wife attempting to get the insurance proceeds. If what you're worried about is collusion or conspiracy, you would have a larger opportunity for that type of collusion or conspiracy in the matrimonial cases than you do in employer-employee relationship cases.
Well, to follow up there, do you think Fiesta Mart was wrongly decided?
Yes, I do believe that Fiesta Mart was wrongly decided. I mean, I think we are taking issue with the line of Fifth Circuit cases which have gone the other way on this.
It's one thing to say, well, the trucking company's driver pulled into somebody when he shouldn't have, and therefore the trucking company was also negligent for entrusting the vehicle and hiring him and training him in the first place. And saying that's covered, that's clearly covered. But if he gets mad at somebody who's honking at him and he runs into him, then that wouldn't be covered. That seems to be a fairly difficult distinction to draw. But then way over here on the other side where you have fraud cases and sexual abuse cases, they seem to be a lot different from the driver's cases.
The difference, I think, has to go with the underlying cause of action. We're more comfortable saying in the negligent driving cases that we didn't train our driver and he ran out and back ended somebody. We're less comfortable in negligent hiring cases saying, well, we didn't train him and he went out and he engaged in some sexual harassment or some intentional fraud. I don't think that the uncomfortableness that you have in extending negligent hiring to those intentional torts for the employer should be spilled over into the coverage dispute because they're two different issues. In both cases, what you have from the insurer's perspective is an accident. Nobody's arguing in this case that Mr. King intended his employee to go out and beat up a man. But on the same token, I think this court would be uncomfortable or less comfortable applying negligent hiring to cases in which you have the employee go out and do an intentional tort. But there's no distinction for the cover. That's not correct. The coverage issue still follows all of the analysis about what is an accident, what is the triggering mechanism for coverage, and that shouldn't depend upon the nature of what the employee did down below. In the underlying suit, it may very well be that there would be a summary judgment or a more appropriate mechanism for getting rid of those cases quicker and sooner than these other cases in which courts you have a negligence of the employee.
But here the question of coverage would never arise if the tort didn't occur. In other words, had there just been an accident of negligent hiring, but no consequence afterwards, then we don't even have to reach the issue at all. The lower court wouldn't, and we wouldn't on a coverage dispute. Here, the only reason that we have the case is because there's a combination. The Fifth Circuit has called it interdependent and related. There's no way that we would have this issue but for the two things, the hiring and then the tort. And as Justice Hankinson was saying, you know, what cases say that we can divorce the two, the occurrence, the quote occurrence in the hiring, but the occurrence in the actual tort?
Well, certainly the separation of insurance cases and the cases cited in the brief support doing that in effect. They don't use the same line of analysis that Justice Hankinson discussed. I do think that one other statement it needs to be made. This is not a case that depends upon an intentional tort. If Mr. Lopez had negligently gotten out of his Bobcat and fallen on the guy, we would still have the case. It's not the fact that it's the underlying tort that is important. And I intended to reserve some time for the amicus to address certain issues. I'm not sure I've done that accurately.
Is there time left for the amicus? Well, he's been answering questions, I think, the whole time, so we'll hear from the advocates.
Would you like me to put another question?
Yes, please.
May it please the Court. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Laura Hollingsworth, and I'm here today on behalf of the Soda Lake and Tarrant Baptist Association. As we stated in our briefs, Your Honors, these associations represent approximately 300 churches and missions across the state, and we are here today in support of Carlisle King. I certainly appreciate the opportunity to argue and address the court this morning. I'm just going to address two quick issues. First, how other jurisdictions have applied the separation of insureds provision in occurrence-based policies, and second, how this court's opinion in the case today could have detrimental effects upon churches, not only my clients, but other charitable organizations across the state.
In doing so, would you focus on those cases specifically dealing with negligent hiring as opposed to either sexual abuse or some of the other cases? It seems that in Appleman's, when Appleman's talks about it, he acknowledges there seems to be a difference in how cases are handled if it's a negligent hiring claim as opposed to some other activities out there. So I want to focus and make sure it's a negligent hiring that's the underlying deal, if you're familiar with that.
Yes, Your Honor. What we have essentially found is that there are five cases that deal with separation of insured provisions in occurrence-based policies. With the same exact definition we have here, involving some type of negligent hiring, supervision, or training. Now, it may not be hiring. It could be supervision of another individual. That does involve an assault. But essentially, the underlying claim is a direct liability claim for some type of negligent supervision, training, or hiring. Of those five cases, four of them have determined that the separation of insureds provision does apply in looking at what an occurrence is. They simply say that the provision requires us to look at it from the standpoint of the insured. The one case that does not do that, Your Honors, is a Fifth Circuit case interpreting Mississippi law. And frankly, that case doesn't discuss why the separation of insureds provision shouldn't be used in looking at an occurrence. Rather, it relies on some older cases involving the related to an interdependent language that there is no indication in the record of those cases that the separation of insureds provision was even part of the consideration of the court. Essentially, the courts that have applied the separation of insureds provision have determined that there are two injury-causing events. That's exactly how they look at it. They look at it in terms of the employer's actions, negligence in training, supervision, or hiring, and then they look at the intentional acts of the tortfeasor, and they do not impute the intentional acts of the tortfeasor. What the insurance companies in this case are asking the court to do is, and they blatantly said it in their briefs, is that the negligent hiring and training isn't the proximate cause of the injuries in this case. But that is basically an impermissible request because this court's already recognized that in certain cases, negligent hiring can be the proximate cause, that it in fact is a recoverable injury under a negligence theory. What the insurance companies have tried to do is make this direct liability claim into a derivative claim, but it's not. In a case, Your Honors, that admittedly we have not cited in any of the briefs, and we would be happy to submit the cite to the court, Young versus the City of DeMitt, this court dealt with a situation in a procurement that was somewhat similar. A governmental agency was being sued on a theory of negligent hiring of an officer that had intentionally driven his car into a group of people. Under the Texas Tort Claims Act, there is no, you cannot sue for intentional acts. The government in that case asserted that they should be allowed to be imputed with the intentional acts of the government actor in order to avoid liability under the Texas Tort Claims Act. What the court came back and said, without reference to whether the Texas Tort Claims Act was applicable, they did say, though, you should not impute that knowledge of the intentional act by the actor to get outside of coverage by the Texas Tort Claims Act.
The opposing amici say that if that's the case, you can always at least state a claim against the employer for negligence in putting an intentionally acting employee in those circumstances. So there would always be at least a duty to defend, if not coverage. What's your response to that?
Your Honor, when the allegations in the petition, when you look at the allegations in this petition, there are no allegations of intent against the employer.
No, I'm not. I'm saying it would happen in every case. It would be an inept lawyer who couldn't state a negligence claim against an employer who put someone in a position to do a wrongful, intentional act.
Certainly, Your Honor, I believe there would be coverage in those cases.
Yeah.
I agree. I think there
would
be.
So we're fighting over all the marbles here, whether it would always cover or not always cover.
I certainly agree, and I think it would be involving cases that extend beyond intentional acts incurring by that were caused by insurers.
But there is a limitation, though, that the negligent hiring always presupposes that you had reason to know of a particular. Negligent hiring isn't an automatic just because an accident occurred. Negligent hiring would be because of the driving record of the driver, or it could be because of the criminal record of the driver, or it could be of something that existed before they were hired that a person in a reasonable position of hiring would not have hired or put them in a position knowing what they knew. So there's a threshold element before the duty about negligent hiring gets breached.
That's correct, Your Honor. And if the facts are alleged in the petition that those initial acts have occurred, then that's what the court has to look at in determining coverage. I mean, that's what this court's told us.
Well, not coverage, just the duty to defend.
That's correct, Your Honor. Just for the duty to defend. I mean, irrespective of the truth or falsity of those allegations, that's what the court has to look at in determining coverage.
Any other questions?
What was the citation of the Young case?
I don't have it right now, Your Honor, but I will have Mr. Wootring provide it to you.
Thank you. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Bonner, do you know what was an argument from the respondent?
May it please this honorable court. I think there are six reasons why this court should affirm the trial court and the Court of Appeals and hold that negligent hiring, training, supervision claims are not occurrences to an employer when the employee commits an intentional act. The first reason is stare decisis based upon opinions out of this court. The first line of cases is the Maupin versus Argonaut case, the Cowan case, the mid-century case, which defined what an accident is. Here we're dealing with a vicious assault. Secondly, the Griffin and McManus cases out of this court, which held...
The first set of cases that you just talked about, none of them involve an allegation against two insureds who are alleged to have committed separate injury-producing, engaged in separate injury-producing conduct.
That's correct.
But we haven't ever addressed this particular point, have we?
No.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure. Thank you.
So that takes care of stare decisis.
Not really. And when we get into discussing the separation of insureds, I think I can explain how you would somewhat erode or have to create an exception to those cases to get where petitioner would like to get. The third case from this court is the National Union versus Merchants case, which held that this court looks at the origin of the damages. The fourth line of cases is the Doe versus Greater Dallas Boys Club, which holds that you look for the but-for cause in determining the injury. The second reason is the potential increase in moral hazard, as this court explained in Cowan when it discussed the Abraham article. The third reason is the potential for increase in insurance rates, as explained in Commercial Union versus Roberts, which is not an opinion from this court, is an opinion from the Western District in the federal system.
Well, or potential for a windfall, as they have claimed. There are two ways to look at that.
Yes. But insurance is fortuity based. And if you're trying to get coverage for something that is not a fortuity, and if you're talking about covering intentional acts or assaults, that is something
that... But that gets us back to the original question, that there's an independent liability basis against the employer separate and apart from the suit, and this court has recognized causes of action that would put liability on the employer. So that's a different scenario, isn't it? I mean, I understand you're saying clearly it's covered, always has been. If we hold that it's not, or there is no duty to defend, you will have a windfall. So those are just two sides of the same argument.
Yes, there's obviously two sides to the argument.
You're both claiming the sky's going to fall if we rule one way or the other.
Yes. I think the fourth reason is I think Texas would join the minority of states that have decided this issue. The fifth reason is I think it will encourage manipulation of pleadings. This court in Gandy eliminated Mary Carter agreements. They eliminated sweetheart deals. They wanted to have the litigation straight up. In this case, the petition of the plaintiffs was pled as an intentional act case. Dallas Fire denied coverage. They then amended their pleading and said, well, you didn't provide training to the employee, so he would know how to handle a situation when someone else came up to him and accused him of stealing something, and so he negligently reacted to this because you didn't give him that type of training. I think maybe the most egregious example is the one cited in the USAA amicus brief where they're talking about the lady in Florida who was murdered by her husband or hired somebody to murder her, and he was convicted, and they sued him and his second wife, and they sued her claiming that she failed to recognize that her husband may be planning a murder, and she negligently did that. So we're talking about encouraging creative pleading to get into coverage. And I suppose the final reason, this court has previously decided a separation of insurers case language in Commercial Standard versus American General back in 1970. And toward the end of the opinion, in the last two pages, they talk about what was the purpose of the separation of insureds clause. And they talked about that the exclusion, some exclusions would say the insured, some exclusions would say any insured, and the purpose of the separation of insured would so each insured could have his or her, its own conduct judged independently. And the purpose, really, what most of these cases involving separation of insureds have been involved in indemnity issues, where one indemnity.
But let's get to looking at the language of the policy, because that's what we're here to talk about, okay. Is interpreting the policy, correct?
Yes.
And understand that your position is that the separation of insureds clause should only be applied to looking at exclusions.
Yes.
And you cited some cases to us, and I know your opponent disagrees
yes.
with it. Those, and we're going to have to read those cases and see what to sort out what they say. But what language in Section 4.7 of the insurance policy, the separation of insureds clause, in any way could be construed to limit the application of that clause to just the exclusions? I'm having a hard time. What would I hang my hat on if I wanted to go your way?
I don't know if there's anything per se in the definition that you could.
Anywhere in the policy, any language in the policy that supports your position?
No, I think you have to look at how it would apply.
Well, if the separation of insurance policy, provision of the policy is not limited to the exclusions in the policy, but in fact is applied to the policy, because it covers any rights or duties specifically assigned in this coverage part to the first named insured, this insurance applies, and so on and so forth. If that were the case, and we are dealing with two separate claims being made against two insureds under the policy for different tortious activity, we not have a vicarious liability claim. We have direct liability claims being made against each for their own conduct. And why wouldn't we apply that in interpreting what an occurrence is and look to the occurrence in the context of the employer in the negligent hiring case separately to determine whether or not there was an accident?
Because it's part of occurrence has got to cause either bodily injury or property damage.
They claim in this that the occurrence of negligently hiring was a proximate cause of the injury that occurred during the altercation.
But then you have to cross the line.
Well, but that's a recognized cause of action in Texas, isn't it? And it's been pled in the case.
It is a recognized cause of action, but then you go back to the Cowan and Mid-Century cases, which hold that you look at the conduct. Was it intentional, voluntary conduct? Certainly, they decided not to do any investigation before they hired Mr. Lopez. They decided not to give him any supervision, not to give him any training. Those are certainly intentional, voluntary acts.
But then the question becomes, were they acting as the reasonably prudent employer when they did it? Because not every employer would have to. I mean, certainly, if I'm driving my car and I run a red light, I can either do it intentionally or I can do it negligently because I just wasn't paying close enough attention. So, again, we're getting back to the merits, and we have to stick to the four corners of the pleading. So I'm trying to understand, if the separation of insurance clause is not limited to exclusions, then wouldn't it be applied to occurrence to treat? I'm having trouble with this idea of the two direct liability theory.
First of all, there has never been a case that has held that the separation of insureds language applies to occurrence. It's always been decided in terms of the exclusions.
Well, let me ask you a question.
Yes.
Let's suppose we have negligent hiring and we have an injury. If the separation of insureds doesn't apply, and if an occurrence means what is argued here intentionally, is it relevant whether or not the injury that occurred, you negligently hired XYZ individual who didn't know how to use the machine properly, intended to use the machine this way, and it caused an injury. To get coverage, is the negligence that you're concerned about for this accident the negligence of the operator of the machine, or is it negligence in the hiring? You're saying you can't separate the occurrence. So I'm having a hard time what I got
to
show.
No, I think it has to be the act of the employee that caused the injury, the but for cause.
It's irrelevant whether or not the hiring, for the purposes of coverage, the occurrence causes coverage, and the occurrence has to be as a direct result of that person's negligence. It's immaterial for coverage purposes about the hiring. I mean, that doesn't play into whether there's coverage, whether or not the hiring was negligent.
I don't believe so, because as this court has said, you look at to determine occurrence, you look at the origin of the damages. The origin of the
I want you to help me understand, because the allegation is that the negligent hiring was an additional proximate cause of the injuries. I mean, you can have more than one but for cause. You can, and it is a proximate cause as well. So if I'm an insured under a policy, an occurrence-based policy, and I am seeking protection from liability for my actions, and someone pleads a cause of action against me that my negligence was the but-for or a proximate cause of the injury, then why wouldn't that be an occurrence under the policy?
Because not all acts of negligence are occurrences. Because to use the deer hypothetical that was used in Cowan, where an individual intended to shoot the deer, ended up shooting another hunter. Suppose you have the hunter out there close to the deer in the line of view, and the hunter says, "I'm really a great shot. I can put it 3 inches to the left of that other hunter's deer, and I can hit the deer." And instead of hitting the deer, he hits the other hunter. Certainly that's an intentional act, and the consequences had to be expected. Was he negligent? Yes, he may have been negligent because his conduct fell below the standard of a reasonable man, but that's not an occurrence. So not all negligence is
so
occurrence.
So you're saying, let's just say we just had a negligent hiring policy. You're saying that negligent hiring can never be an occurrence?
No, because in this case, they hired exactly who they wanted to hire. They gave exactly the training they wanted to give, and they gave exactly the supervision. Those are intentional and voluntary acts.
But if I drive my car into an intersection when I shouldn't, and I get hit, I intended to drive my car into the intersection.
Yes,
but that doesn't make that an intentional tort.
But automobile policies are not occurrence-based. They are, we will pay for your liability.
So when would we ever have a negligence? Tell me what would be an occurrence that would not be subject to the exclusion for intentional conduct. Because we intend to do what we're doing.
The classic example was the one given in Cowan, where the man is out hunting in the bushes. He sees a deer, he shoots for the deer, and for some reason, some hunter pops up and gets shot. The man certainly intended to pull the trigger. He did not intend the consequences of hitting the other hunter, and that was sort of out of the ordinary, not expected or intended, because we're assuming he did not see.
Well, how's that different than your negligence hiring? I intend to hire this person, but in hiring that person, I certainly don't intend that person to go off and go a different direction and kill somebody. How's that different than intending to shoot a bullet that I intended to kill?
Because the negligent hiring, training, and supervision was not the but-for cause of the injury to the plaintiff in the underlying case.
Again, you keep saying it's the damage to the third party, whether it's negligence or tort, that controls the separation and
yes.
Well, this is a rather sinister example, but let's suppose that my wealthy father was aged and ill, and I wanted to hurry along his demise, and I hired a nurse that I knew to be incompetent, hoping that she would mismedicate him or over-medicate him and shorten his life. And she did so negligently, not intentionally. But that was the intended result on my part. Now, who would be insured under that policy? She's my employee.
It's a tough hypothetical.
Thank you. you come down to an intentional act. You intentionally hired who you wanted to hire.
Knowing she was incompetent. She was just incompetent. She was had no ill.
I should, well. I don't think under the cases decided by this court, there would be coverage for that claim. Because it's an intentional act. You hired who you wanted to hire. And the injuries were those injuries that you wanted inflicted upon father, father-in-law.
But this is arguing it's the negligence of the actor that counts, not the person that did the hiring. So the nurse was negligent. You argued it's the person, it's the nurse's deal that makes the difference. Isn't it? So I'm lucky. I intended to hire an incompetent, and they were negligent just like I intended, but
well,
that's the only thing.
As I understood Justice Owen's hypothetical, she had the intent to hire somebody she knew was incompetent and knew that they would give ill treatment or bad treatment to her father.
But for occurrence, as you say, for coverage, it only depends on that final person, the nurse. It only depends if she's negligent.
But there you come to her act was an intentional act.
But what about the employees? Is she covered? She's additional insured under the policy.
I suppose.
And she was negligent.
If she was negligent and she was covered under the policy, then she might have coverage.
But why are we going to these nuances? This is a duty to defend case. Why are we reserving all these hypotheticals and nuances for the coverage issue and giving broad interpretation to the eight corners right now?
Because I'm here answering the hypotheticals.
Well, let's answer my question.
Didn't really have a choice.
Let's answer my question now. Why don't we give broad interpretation to the eight corners? This is a duty to defend.
This is a duty to defend, but I think you have to answer the threshold question here: is claims of negligent hiring, supervision, training, occurrences under an occurrence-based policy, which has deleted the language. Many of the other cases that have been cited in support of petitioner's argument either do not have the same definition of occurrence that's in Dallas Fire's policy, or there are different types of policies that do not have an occurrence-based policy. Or if they are an occurrence-based policy, they maybe have the language from the standpoint of the insured. Or some of the cases that have decided this petitioner's way are theory-based states. They say, okay, you've been sued for negligence. We're not going to look any further. We're not going to look at the facts. That's all we're going to look at.
Mr. Tigner, in order to get where you would like for us to go, don't we have to go with the Court of Appeals interdependence analysis that has been used there and in some other courts? I mean, don't you actually have to take two alleged separate torts and tie them together so that the actual last tort fees are in the chain that caused the incident? That's the conduct that you look to. Don't you have to tie all the conduct together in order to get where you want to go?
To some extent, but if you just follow National Union versus Merchants, which says you look at the origin of the injury, the but for.
Well, I understand, but assume that I'm not with you on that argument.
Okay.
How am I going to get there?
Then I think the decisions from the Fifth Circuit, which have been authored by Judge Higginbotham, which have been authored by Judge Jerry Smith, which have been authored by Judge Emilio Garza, which have been authored by Judge Edith Jones, which talk about this dependent and interdependent conduct, are right on point.
Let me ask you, because I'm not sure I'm clear on your position. If, in this case, if the actor's conduct, the employee's conduct, had been negligent, would there be coverage of the negligent hiring claim against the employer?
Probably under the respondeat superior claim.
But otherwise not.
Probably otherwise not.
So in other
and
words,
I don't understand why.
Because again, we come down to It was the intentional act issue. Voluntary conduct.
Well, but you know that gets pretty metaphysical. I mean, he intended to do it just like I intended to pull out the intersection. I just shouldn't have done it. Anybody with a brain wouldn't have done it. He shouldn't have hired this guy. He intended to hire him. But if he looked for 10 minutes and found out that he had a history of beating up everybody he worked with, they would have said, well, maybe we shouldn't put this guy
out. As a practical matter, that issue probably never would arise because if they're going to give a defense to the employee, they're also going to give a defense to the employer.
But under your scenario, then, if I understand you correctly, let's assume that it could happen, then there would not be coverage for negligence. Your view is there's no coverage for negligent hiring because it's an intentional act. Period. Regardless of the facts.
It's in those situations where the underlying injury was caused by an act excluded by the policy.
All right, but then going back to Justice Heck's hypothetical, let's say that that employee was negligent, and I know we can have a vicarious liability theory pled, but let's say they go ahead and plead, they don't plead that, they plead an independent tort against the employer for negligent hiring. Is there going to be a duty to defend that employer?
And the reason
so, but that's...
Well, then why would there be under that circumstance and not under the other? Since the basis for your saying there's no duty to defend on negligent hire is because it's intentional conduct.
Because the injury-causing event was excluded from coverage.
Well, then that goes. Then that tells us that your real theory is the interdependence theory that the Fifth Circuit and some other courts have used. Area. Then, if I understand you correctly, let's assume that it could happen. Then there would not be coverage for negligent. Your view is there's no coverage for negligent hiring because it's an intentional act. Period. Regardless of the facts.
It's in those situations where the underlying injury was caused by an act excluded by the policy.
All right, but then going back to Justice Heck's hypothetical, let's say that that employee was negligent, and I know we can have a vicarious liability theory pled, but let's say they go ahead and plead, they don't plead that, they just plead an independent, they plead an independent tort against the employer for negligent hiring. Is there going to be a duty to defend that employer?
And the reason
so, but that's...
Well, then why would there be under that circumstance and not under the other? Since the basis for your saying there's no duty to defend on negligent hire is because it's intentional conduct.
Because the injury-causing event was excluded from coverage.
Well, then that goes... Then that tells us that your real theory is the interdependence theory that the Fifth Circuit and some other courts have used.
I think that is correct, but there are also other decisions of this court in analyzing other cases, and I think this court has to reconcile and be consistent with its other opinions. And I think when you consider the National Union Merchants case, which says you look at the origin of the cause of the injury as part of the occurrence evaluation, because occurrences, it's not just an accident, it has to cause bodily injury, and to satisfy the component of bodily injury, you have to cross the line. You have to look at the conduct that is excluded. So yes, you're right, you do have to look at those cases, the dependent and interdependent cases, but also those cases are consistent. The other cases from this court on you look at facts versus theories, and you look at the but-for cause of the injury, and you look at the origin of the injury.
But, Linda, I'm a little confused too still. When we look at the employee in this case, he's another insured under the policy, isn't he?
Yes.
Clearly, he's not covered because his act was intentional.
That's correct.
And so, as suggested, the only way you could get to the separate causes of action against the employer being not covered either is by the interdependence theory.
That is correct, but that is somewhat of an offshoot or consistent with what this court has held in the Merchants case, that you look at the origin of the injury, and that may be just a semantics issue.
Well, would you agree that the origin of the injury means the conduct of the person you're looking at, in this case, the violent employee?
Yes. It is the but-for cause.
You're looking at the injury, not the damages. There's a difference. No,
the injury was caused by the assault.
The violent, the assault.
Yes.
And clearly, since he's an added insured, he's not covered.
That's correct.
But as Justice Rodriguez suggests, we're just looking at a duty to defend. And don't we have to take, under our jurisprudence, the allegations of the pleading as true within the four corners of the policy?
As the facts pled as being true, that is correct.
And so under that theory, the facts pled are negligent hiring, negligent training, and negligent supervision led to this injury. That's what they say.
The facts are no investigation, no training, no supervision.
Yes.
And those are intentional acts.
Have you ever said that before in this case, in your briefs?
I believe so.
Was that a basis for the denial of the insured, when you denied the insured?
I'm sorry?
When you all denied the insured coverage on this policy, was that argument
initiated? Yes, we said that there was no occurrence. That was one of the bases.
But as opposed to saying no occurrence because the assault was an intentional act, did you articulate in your denial letter the negligent hiring was an intentional act?
I don't recall.
But just so I'm clear, my understanding is that your position would be there would never be coverage for negligent hiring, training, or supervision in any situation. Or I'm sorry, duty to defend.
When the injury-causing act is excluded from coverage.
I'm sorry. Based on your statement, though, I thought you said the employer's act was intentional.
It is certainly an intentional act. We have two intentional acts. We got the conduct. They made a business decision as to who they wanted to hire.
I understand. And that you're saying that intent takes them out of coverage.
That intent combined with the but-for cause of the underlying plaintiff's injury.
Well, that sounds kind of like interdependence to me.
Well, I suppose it is, and maybe I... Yes.
So, basically, as suggested from the other end of the bench, we should adopt the Fifth Circuit's viewpoint of how these kind of cases are reviewed. And do I also understand the reason why the separation of insureds doesn't work here is your view that it applies only to the exclusion parts of the policy?
That's one, but you also, I suppose it's maybe like Justice Cardozo said in the Paul's Graph case, which we all, where, I'm sorry, did...
Well, we had a long discussion in another case about Paul's Graph.
Where he said negligence in the air is...
Yes, it kind of gets to me when somebody cites it. I'm sorry. Go ahead, please.
Lost my train of thought.
I'm sorry. Excuse me.
Any other questions?
Not by me.
Thank you.
The citation to the Young case is 787 Southwest 2nd 50. It's reconfirmed by Texas Department of Public Safety versus PETA, and that's 44 Southwest 3rd 575.
What was the page site? 77 Southwest 2nd?
787 Southwest 2nd 50. And the PETA case was 44 Southwest 3rd 575. The citation to separation of insureds provision is page 55 of the record. What it says is, except with respect to the limits of insurance and any rights or duties specifically assigned in this coverage part to the first named insured, this insurance applies, and the portion B is, separately to each insured against whom claim is made or suit is brought. There's no language in there limiting it to exclusions.
Okay.
Would you respond to his argument that negligent hiring does not cause bodily injury and therefore cannot be an occurrence? If I understood him correctly, I think that's what he said.
Well, I think there's several objections to that. If this court is going to hold there's no cause of action for negligent hiring, that might be something Carlisle King would be willing to agree to, given this circumstances. However, I think this court has, or the courts of Texas have determined there is such a cause of action. You can break down any negligent act into its constituent parts and determine that it's intentional. There is an intent to hire Mr. Lopez. There was an intent, a volitional act, not to do a background check on him. But there was no intent that he would go out and cause the harm or the injury. I think for intentional torts, it's more of a specific intent. And therefore, there's going to be liability for negligence.
Well, it seems to me Trinity Universal was talking about that example. If I intended to hire and I intended not to train, there's nothing about that that means that I intended for my employee to go out and beat somebody up. So I think that's Trinity Universal.
Correct.
What I understand the argument to be is you can't get to the injury but for the intentional conduct of the employee, and that's the problem with the Fifth Circuit case, is the interdependence. There's no way that you can get to the injury but going through the intentional act of this employee getting there. And as a result, whether they were negligent or not negligent in the hiring process, you just can't get to that injury.
Well,
but for an intentional act of an employee, an insurance policy wasn't designed to cover that kind of circumstance because it's an occurrence policy as opposed to an automobile liability policy or a premises policy. This is an occurrence policy. And so the critical aspect about this is this occurrence has to be the result of an accident, and since you can't get there but for the intentional conduct of that employee, this is not an accident.
Well, that is certainly something that the Fifth Circuit on occasion has found attractive, and more often than not, that reasoning.
Because of all the questions we've had here today, they said that's an easy way out.
That's exactly right. I do think there's some background uncomfortableness with negligent hiring and training cases and intentional torts for employees, and that also colored their analysis. Those interdependent related upon, that language comes from exclusion cases and the liquor liability exclusion that is relied upon heavily by the Court of Appeals. That's the Thornhill liquor liability, Sentinel Insurance, and that's the motor vehicle exclusion, in which case the analysis has been if you're trying to get coverage based upon things that were not in the insurance policy, and you have to go through those areas that were not insured against, then we're not going to give you coverage for them. Perhaps a final point, or probably 2 points, if I could.
Is there a question?
Thank you.
No, I mean, there might be.
Fine.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes today's arguments, and the marshal will now adjourn the court.
All rise.